www.amateurradio.tango-victor, run by Mike number 1, KC2NJI. On one or two occasions, local interference or something like that came along, and so Mike number 1 was not able to make a recording. And good old Roy took his recording of the TechNet and presented it to Mike. Therefore, some of the recordings you can listen to when you go to that website to listen to past events of this TechNet. You think you're hearing Mike number 1's recording. In some cases, you're hearing a recording that was done by good old Roy. So it was coming from Brooklyn, not from from Hawthorne, New Jersey. That's where Mike number 1 lives. So Roy has already done recording of the TechNet. So he could, I guess, in this case, just do another one of those recordings, which I presume is being done on a hard drive. And so by way of a dongle or whatever, I guess that recording could be presented to Donna. That's what possibly Roy is volunteering to do. I'm amazed he's about to volunteer for altogether here. AC2GS, K2LIW. Go ahead, Roy.
Yeah, it's no problem. I record Limark, I record the radio club repeater, I record lots of things. There's 8 streams on this radio of mine, so there's no waiting.
Okay, so once again, this is a ham radio equivalent of an Irish wake. Is due to take place on this frequency, 146.85, and probably you'll also involve the 147.375, this coming Friday, August 18th, if I got the date right, starting at roughly 9 o'clock at night. Anybody need any further fills as to what's going to take place, please gather anybody you know who has had these very long conversations with Roy that sometimes went until the sun rises. Anybody who remembers some of those events and are willing to relay them to the rest of the group, that's the right place to gather and disperse that information. Anybody need any further fills or any further explanation, give me your call letters right now. K2LIW, the Tech Man.
Why else?
You got it, Bernie.
Order. This is now officially called a ham wake.
Yeah, he created the conversations that were the ultimate rag shoe. I mean, there's a certificate you can get in ham radio called the rag shoe certificate, which I think you're supposed to talk to one guy for at least a half hour or an hour. And so as a rag shoeer, John was second to none. It was a combination of what John did and what Roy is suggesting that's creating this wake. I think they both deserve a credit on this one. Without Roy, it wouldn't have taken place, even though John was really the chief rag-shoer in this particular case. That's an opinion. AC2GS, for any other comments? K2LIW, go ahead, Roy.
Well, I think we all summed it up. Get everyone who knew John, and there's a lot of people that knew John, there's a lot of people who talked to John, and what the hell, even guys who just listened to John, because maybe they have something to say as well. And let's see how late into the night we can cause this to be. You know, we're going to start something, so let's start it with a record. How's that?
Good question. I have no answer yet. But do you?
As you guys probably remember, John, for a number of years, was the head of the mailbag. In other words, amateur radio operators, or future ham radio operators, sometimes college students. Let me drop. Who either didn't have their ham license yet or didn't have the right equipment so they can talk to us directly on this repeater. Still, they listened to the TechNet on their scanners, and realize how much fun we're having, and they had technical questions, and they would send a snail mail, an email, bird dropping, whatever, to John. There were some weeks in which he got as many as 76 questions in his mailing system, and he would choose the best of those questions, 2, 3, 4, 5 of them, each individual week during the mailbag section that we used to begin somewhere around 9 o'clock, but sometimes more delayed, and then we would discuss the mailbag questions as well as the questions that people had asked directly over the air. So John was maintaining the mailbag for quite a number of years. Some years ago, that was also being done by K2KEY, Mel, who also became a silent key. And that's something to worry about a little bit. We've had now two mailbag people, both of which have become silent keys. But when a net lasts for 35 years, you have to expect that. This is a bit unusual. Okay, before I go over to Wes's question, is there anyone else that needs any further fills, and what's going to take place 9 o'clock, this repeater, this coming Friday night? Anybody need any further fills? Gather your information, and let's all meet together. If you've got any further questions, give it to me right now, K2LIW.
Chairman.
Go ahead, Charlie.
Dick, I gotta do my thing, otherwise I gotta dig out of here.
Yeah, everybody says, handle me now or I'm not gonna be able to, Okay. Go ahead, Charlie. Whiskey Alpha 2, Hotel Mike, K2LIW. If you go ahead, Charlie.
Yeah, hi guys. This is WA2HMM Charlie out here in town. I'd like to make a comment on the new mode that Joe Taylor has put upon us. At the moment it's in beta testing. It's Fox Tango 8, FT8. You probably can remember what FT65 is, which is for EME and stuff like that. Very, very low noise. Digging into the noise to pull out signals. FDA will take you down to about minus 20 dB. Let me drop a minute. The new mode is easy to load, easy to run. The only boogaboo that you have is that the time base in your PC is really not accurate enough. But there's a couple of free programs that you can run. One is called Net Time. The other one is NTP, November Tango Papa. And that makes your time base extremely accurate. And you have to run one of those programs. I am presently running Net Time. You can find out information on this under the WSJT-X homepage. There's a nice user guide that Joe has written. Very, very user-friendly. Very, very well written. Hang on a second. One problem with running this mode at the moment, ARRL, Logbook of the World, still is not accepting FT8. QSOs. There is a table called an ADIF table that has to be updated, and LODA has to be updated also, which is coming down the line. It's coming. The nice thing about it is like, for instance, right now, I am monitoring 40 meters. 40 meters, I just have a simple inverted C. And I'm copying St. Lucia, England, Cuba, Canada, Hungary, Belgium, Colombia, there's a Swedish station, there's a Swiss station on, and it's perfectly Q5 copy using FT8. So you guys might want to check it out. It's all free. Everything is free. It just takes a little time to load it in. And when you go to the WSJTX website, what you want to look for is the 1.8.0.RC1. That's the program that'll give you FT8. And it's habit forming, so be careful. K2RAW WA2HMM.
Now, the Nobel laureate named Joe Taylor, K1 Juliet Tango, guy who won the Nobel Prize for what he did with radio astronomy, was listening to pulsars that had a Doppler shift, a very significant experiment that he did 15 or 20 years ago. He works at Princeton University. He has invented a whole lot of weak signal digital modes, WSJT modes. And so this latest mode, FT8, I believe it differs because it transmits and listens in 15-second periods instead of 60-second periods. That's some of the difference. You have been using it for how long, Charlie? And do you know of other advantages? In other words, when it comes to certain kinds of communication where you may not... The fade rate is such that with 60-second periods, you might miss the QSO, whereas with 15-second periods, as long as your timing is accurate enough, let me drop this. This FT8 mode would allow you to make QSOs you wouldn't ordinarily be able to make. These are some of my guesses as to what the difference is with FT8 versus some of the other WSJT modes. You have been using FT8 for how long, Charlie? And what's your guess right now? Is only 1% of the elite amateur radio operators using FT8? It's something that's only been around for a short period of time. Make a guess on that one. WA2HMM, K2LIW in the TechNet. You got it, Charlie.
WA2HMM. I've been using it now for about 2 weeks, and as I said, it's habit forming. I do both electronic logbook and paper logbook, and I've gone through about 10 pages of logging contacts. The actual QSO, it depends upon how much information you pack into the QSO. But each transfer is about 15 seconds. 15 seconds transmit, 15 seconds receive, 15 seconds transmit. Basically, it's you're calling the person, he's responding to you, you're responding to him, with a roger, roger, and a signal report. He comes back and he says roger, roger, and then it's 73. But of course, you can always pack some other messages in there. There's one attribute there where you can put your own message into the transmitted signal. Like on 10 meters, I put in stuff for my the 10-10 net stuff. We want. As far as. How many people are using it? Right now I'm monitoring 40 meters, and effectively the screen is just scrolling with CQs, people calling back and forth. There's DX on there, folks from down south. Let's see, there's a German on here now, a DL9, an ON7, a guy from Greece, Sierra Victor 9, and looking at the spectrum scope, and they are strong. Strong as far as FT8 goes, Dick.
Yeah, like many of these digital modes, I presume FT8, Fox Tango 8, can tolerate a signal of something like minus 20 decibels signal-to-noise ratio. It may be a little bit weaker than that. So there are times when the signal... when you listen to a single sideband receiver listening to the signal, you almost hear nothing, and yet the signal is appearing on the screen because the demodulating program says, I'm hearing all those tones, and this is what it's saying. You've been using it for 2 weeks. What's your guess as to how long Fox Tango 8 mode of digital transmission has existed, Charlie? And how did you come about it? Did somebody say, hey, Charlie, this is the best thing since baked bread, you better try it? Or were you reading about it in QST magazine, which I don't remember seeing it there, but probably it's there. So how did you find out about it? How long has it existed? And then has it existed for 3 months? What took you 2.5 months to find it? WA2HMM, KQRI, W Bear, Charlie.
NWA2HMM. Well, Dick, in all honesty, I found out about it by, I was working PSK-31 on 20 meters. I was talking to a gentleman in Mississippi, and he said, have you heard about the new mode FD8? This goes back about 2 weeks now. And I said, nope. And he said, and he started talking to me about it. And he said, switch up to the 20 sideband, which I did. And we started talking. We had a nice long kiss, so I guess we talked for about an hour or so. And he talked me into downloading it, giving it a shot. And it's, as I said, it's like PSK. It can have it for me. I mean, I'm sitting here watching QSOs that I probably never would be able to do on 40 meters. And by the way, 20 watts is considered QRO, high power. The average person is working 5 watts or 10 watts into a wet noodle. I spoke to a fellow over in Belgium the other day. He was running 2 watts into a dipole in his attic. And I copied every single word he said. But right now the program is in beta. But there was a bunch of people doing alpha testing. And I could not tell you when that was started. There's probably some information if somebody wanted to Google it and check it out. But that's all I got for you, Dick. And I'm going to have to run. The pup wants to go out. And when he wants to go out, I got to go. K2RIW. And anybody else who's got any quick questions, I'll hang around for a few. WA2HMM.
To a person who is already equipped with PSK-31, as some of the WSJT weak signal Joe Taylor modes, I have the impression that the front-end equipment is almost the same. You load a new program and make sure you have more accurate timing. Is that approximately what's required to go from PSK-31 over to Fox Tango 8 to B2HMM, K2LIW?
You hit the nail right on the head, Dick. Absolutely. Absolutely. Again, all you gotta do is download NetTime, which is a free program, and run it. And it locks everything up and off you go. Off you go running. Very simple to run, very simple to load. And the tutorial, it's so well written. You can read it once. And you can set up the program to run. Basically, all you got to do is put in your call sign and your maidenhead grid locator, and off you go.
Now you've given us the web address to find this URL, and the URL you gave us ended with X, and I've never seen a URL that ends with X. Does it end with a? Something else, com, nav, whatever. Give us the URL that we go to, or can we just simply Google the word weak signal, Joe Taylor, and FT8? What's the easiest way to find the website? Over to you, Charlie, Mr. HMM, K2LIW.
Way to do it is bring up Google, or Yahoo, or whatever. And put in WSJT-X, Whiskey, Sierra, Juliet, Tango-X-Ray. And just go to the homepage. The homepage is Princeton, something or other, it's a big long thing. So I'm not even going to attempt to try to read it off.
Since Joe Taylor works at Princeton University in New Jersey, that makes sense. It would be a great big long thing with Princeton. Okay. So, Charlie has just given us a rundown on this new whiz-bang mode called Fox Tango 8. It seems to have all kinds of good advantage. If any of you guys have any further questions for Charlie, give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW and TechNet listening. Looks like Charlie's off the hook. Looks like there's no further questions. I know that Wes and 2XJN had a question on a previous subject. Go right ahead, Wes, K2RIW.
The two questions. One is about telemetry in terms of planetary science or planetology, to be more accurate in it. Paul, what interesting stories you could say about that, and Dick as well. Now, the second question is, Dick, you mentioned 1 terawatt impulse. I somehow didn't catch how long was an impulse, and what was the frequency of an impulse. And to again.
Yeah, the Montauk Point radar, the majority of the design was done by Sperry Gyroscope Company way back in the late 60s. It is a AGIS radar, Air Defense Identification Zone radar. There's quite a few of them scattered around the borders of the United States, and that radar was looking for anything coming over the horizon that shouldn't be there, so to speak. The radar radiated pulses of approximately 10 megawatts for the pulse coming out of the transmitter. The signal was at around 435 megacycles and went into an antenna that is 135 feet wide, a rotating radar antenna on top of that building out in Montauk Point. You go to that, let me drop. You take a drive out to Montauk Point, and a couple of miles before you get to the lighthouse, there's a little bit of a hill you go up to, which has got a little bit of a parking area where you get the sort of a scenic overlook. And if you look down to the southeast, below the hill that you're standing on, you will see this six-story concrete building with this 135-foot-wide antenna on top of that building. That is the Montauk Point radar as it was created in the early 60s, I think it was. That radar, as I said, has a 10-megawatt peak envelope power out of the transmitter. The antenna probably has 30 or 35 decibels of gain. So 1 megawatt with 30 dB of gain gives you 1 gigawatt. The antenna is not 30 dB of gain, it's got around 35 or 37 dB of gain. It's not 1 megawatt, it's 10 megawatts. You put that all together, the peak envelope power in the main lobe of that antenna is getting close to 1 terawatt. That radar could really look over the horizon. I think that's the information you were looking for, Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW, it was potent. What that did to, just to give you an idea as to how strong that radio was, When the band was a little bit open between me and Montauk Point, when the main lobe of that radar swept by my house, I could take the antenna off of my 432 receiver. The amount of signal picked up by the 12-volt wiring to my power supply going through the bypass capacitor of my 432 converter gave me a signal that was probably S9. The radar pulses were S9 with no antenna, just a coupling through my power supply wiring. That gives you some idea as to how strong that signal was. And 2XJN, K2RIW.
You gave me the driving power and the gain factor, but didn't give me the timing. The time of an impulse and repeatedness of the impulse. I'm trying to find out by that, also somehow picture it inside. Was it 1 nanosecond? it couldn't be because at times.
I think the pulse recurrence frequency was something like 330 pulses per second. Each pulse was approximately 10 microseconds long. Approximately 10 microseconds long. And some of those pulses were chirped. In other words, the signal came on the air on one frequency, slowly slid to another frequency during the 10 microseconds. So I think it was a pulse compression radar. Approximately 10 microsecond pulse duration, approximately 330 pulse repetition rate. And 2XJN, K2RIW.
It's 10 microseconds. There must have been a huge dedicated power line that was going to this building with a huge, I don't know what number, gauge. I believe there was a special transformer from high voltage to low voltage or to 440 at that example. I'm trying to find out how much power was delivered to the building to handle 10 microseconds. It's huge. And do it here.
You're trying to calculate the average power, and I'm doing that right now. Times 330. Okay. It had a 0.3. Times 10 megawatts. 10 exponential 6. Okay. The average radiated power was 33 kilowatts. 33 kilowatts of average output power. That magnetron 2, was it a magnetron? No, it was a carcinotron. It was a fancy tube. I remember seeing the actual tube. Let me drop it. The tube probably ran a little bit below 50% efficiency. So to transmit 33 kilowatts of average power, they were probably putting 66 kilowatts of raw power into it. And 2XJN, K2RIW.
I was thinking it was much more than that, but you calculated. 33 kilowatts is not that bad. the average... Do we have electrician in here? What is the average power coming from the transformer that is mounted on the neighborhood center again?
There are houses in my neighborhood that have 200 ampere service and 240 volts. So 200 times 240. 2 times 10 to the 4 times 10 to the 4. So you could put 45 kilowatts of raw power into a two-family house on Long Island. Back to you, Wes, and 2XJN, K2RIW.
Thank you very much for that. As far as polarimetry goes, I was thinking if we have light, which is electromagnetic wave, and it bounces from different bodies, and it is refracted, diffracted, or whatever we could think is happening to that, how could we find really how much light is coming from this particular star or galaxy? But also, if we go there to microscale, we have also, in the distance of 10 feet, we could have also light that is differently polarized. And how could we find exactly what is the density or what is the light level or the power of the electromagnetic wave that is coming from that direction, despite the fact of polarization, that's what she is.
You use the word light. You use the word light on a couple of occasions. I'm talking about a radio telescope, not an optical light telescope. Radio telescopes measure power flux density in units called Jansky. Jansky is, I believe, 10 to the minus 22 watts per square meter per cycle per second. Now, there's a way of doing it with hertz, but if you know what I mean. So, in Jansky units is the magnitude. The polarization is rated as to what percentage of it is clockwise, what percentage of it is counterclockwise. And all of that is rated at individual microwave frequency. So as you sweep in frequency, there's another phenomenon as to how fast does the amplitude change as a function of frequency. Is the power slanted up or slanted down as you change in frequency? Is the polarization shifting? So when you measure all of that power, flux, density, signal strength, and polarimetry characteristics, and you're using a radio telescope that is looking at the signal coming directly from that star. If you've got a good cell, let me drop. If you've got a good self-respecting radio telescope, there is no local reflection. You've done all you can in the design of that radio telescope antenna to make sure you're not seeing any phony signals from ground reflection, tree reflection, building reflection. You're just looking at that direct signal coming from that star. And in some cases, you've even put some hardware out in space to aid in those measurements. And in some cases, you make those measurements over a number of months or years to see if the characteristics are changing, particularly if it's something like the Crab Nebula, which exploded in the year 1550, I think it was, on the 4th of July, is when the Crab Nebula exploded. And when that star exploded, people were seeing that star in the daytime for a couple of weeks. The change in power coming out of that star and the polarimetry characteristics as a function of time tells you an awful lot about what was the original explosion and what has it developed into. And is there a local neutron star? Is there a local pulsar? Is there a local black hole? And so on. By these kinds of measurements, in many cases, you can derive that information. N2XJN, K2RIW.
The imaging polarimetry, where the polarization is measured as a function of position in imaging data, they call it spectral polarimetry. And that is where the polarization is measured as a function of wavelength of light. So I was thinking about light. In my particular situation, when I try to measure the source of radiation, despite the fact what frequency it is, so let's say it's in the visible spectrum, light spectrum. I'm thinking also about polarization of the light in terms of me being able to properly read the average light density that is coming in this particular spectrum to the detector. So that's why I was thinking, how do they do it with planets and to experience?
You said, how do they do it with planets? Do you mean how do they do it with stars? Over to you.
It's correct, but also with planets, because when you have a light reflected from the planet, then they do it with planets as well. It depends what you are interested with. Are you interested with quasars? You interested with galaxies? Or you interested in the middle bodies? And you're trying to, let's say, find the light intensity, and based on the spectral polarimetry from solar bodies. Interesting.
Okay, so you just told us they're making measurements on stars, they're making measurements, similar measurements on planets. Okay? You told us they're doing that. What's your question?
Question is, how they are able to find
Operation Ghost Shield.
And now it's differently polarized as well, or originally was differently polarized in many different spectrum. How could you find the average amount of light coming from the particular body as you're seeing?
If your radio telescope has a coherent receiver and a pair of receivers that are coherent, that means they share a common local oscillator. But two independent receivers, two independent IF strips, two independent detectors. But they share a common local oscillator. And if one of those receivers is connected to the feed horn of a radio telescope that's horizontally polarized, the other receiver is connected to a feed horn that is vertically polarized, and you measure the horizontal antenna power, the vertical antenna power, and the phase angle between the two, you've now made a polarimetry measurement at that frequency. By knowing the phase angle and two orthogonal polarizations, one horizontal, one vertical, in my example, you could also do it with one clockwise and one counterclockwise. Again, those are orthogonal polarizations. So if you've got two orthogonal polarizations going into two separate side-by-side receivers that are measuring amplitude of each and phase angle of each, that tells you everything you want to know about that signal. Now, whether or not that signal bounced off some local cloud that was near that star, how do you determine that? That's not easy. N2XJN, K2IW.
Then if we go to the microscale, you have a room or you have a corridor with many doors, and you have a similar situation as if you were bouncing from the clouds. Don't you think so?
Okay, now you've run into a very serious language barrier. I heard some sounds, I wasn't able to make sense out of it. Try rewording that.
Okay. If you try to picture the situation that happened when the radio wave bounced from the clouds, and that cloud acts as a prism, we usually have in particular situations two prisms, which one is polarized and the other one is analyzed. But we have a natural phenomena, and that is actually giving us a banded or reflected light in given direction that is differently polarized. If we could think about a corridor with many side doors and they are open and we put the electromagnetic wave there, don't you think that a similar situation is happening with the microwave that is bouncing out of the walls and open doors as if we have in a big scale with the clouds? And to explain.
With rare exceptions, every star you look at, because the star itself is on average 1,000 miles in diameter or less, the sun, for instance, is 890 miles in diameter, rough number. And our star is an average-sized star, our sun. But you're looking at most of those stars, except for the sun, you're looking at them at 10, 100, 1,000, a million light years away. To your radio telescope, that star is almost always a point source. It is a source so small in diameter, in angular diameter, that your radio telescope, with rare exception, except for very long baseline interferometry that uses the whole dawn diameter of the Earth, except for that, you do not resolve the details of the star. With rare exception, let me drop.
Very good point.
With rare exception, that star is a point source. In the case of Crab Nebula, which was dust from that exploding star is spread out over a number of light years of diameter, maybe tens of light years of diameter. So the cloud is very distributed. The source of the signal that's lighting up that cloud is a point source. So if your radio telescope has enough angular resolution in azimuth and elevation, they call it right ascension and declination, but you know what I mean. If horizontally and vertically it has enough resolution, the fact that the cloud is spread out and the star is a point source gives you a lot of information as to who's doing what. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Thank you very much. It was a very good answer. I mean, very, very clear. I think maybe Dr. Roy and our space experts, both of you guys, maybe you have something to say about it.
Yeah, it turns out that Paul, our space expert, quite often covers the radio telescope. Now, of the people who signed in, that was Joe, Sam, did I go to Bob? Yes, I think I went to Bob. November, Victor Bravo? No, I don't think we did. Let's see if Bob is still there. I hope we haven't put him asleep. Kilo Delta 2, November, Victor Bravo. K2RIW, go ahead, Bob.
Hi, this is Bob. November, Victor Bravo. Hi, Dick. Yeah, I'm still here. With every word, I get what I get, and I direct a shift to me at this time. I'm a newbie. If I was on 2 weeks ago, I was talking about going to Minnesota and picking up the repeaters. It's like 13 miles away on an island we were staying on. Anyway, I took this Rich K2UPS. I ordered an elk antenna at Lab Periodic handheld, and also I've had strange emails with Roy AC2GS. At King's Radio Club, and he's been very helpful with details and getting cabling all. Anyway, I have a question. I don't know if this is a good question for you guys. It's probably too basic and all, but I went to driving to Canada with my aunt and uncle, and also Roy helped me with this. I ordered a Magnum car antenna, half meter, or 2 meter and 440. I just have a little, like, foul thing, handheld. So, I think there's any tips about how do you make contact as you're going down, driving like across the southern edge of Canada, you know, from like basically through Ontario, maybe from Quebec, up to Fort Francis, Ontario, International Park, Minnesota area. Maybe this is just stuff I already know, like looking at the repeaters on the internet and all that. And if so, I apologize for wasting your time, but maybe somebody can share some things that would help me out. So, over to you, Dick. Thanks.
Yeah, I have the impression, Bob, I have the impression that you're taking an automobile trip as opposed to a train or a plane. So in your automobile, while you're traveling through upper New York State and lower Canada and so on, while you're traveling, you'd like to know what to listen to and how to talk to people. By way of the repeater guide that you can buy from QST, among other places, and there are websites, you can find out the frequencies of the RF signal, the frequencies of the PL tones, if there are any, for any of those repeaters, and their town of location and what their general coverage is. So there's ways you can find out what repeaters are going to be in the vicinity of where you're driving. That's one third of the problem. Let me drop this. So almost any trip you take, if you have a complete enough repeater guide, you're going to discover that you're driving in the vicinity of 30 separate repeaters. I picked that number out of here, but it's a big number. You're going to be driving by a whole lot of repeaters.
K2UPS.
And there's a guy, K2UPS, who does a lot of traveling. Now, in the case of a handy-talky radio, like a Baofeng or whatever, inside the car, you'll get some coverage. Any kind of a mag mount antenna you can put on the outside of the car. Bring the cable and we're connected to the radio. Your signal is 10 times you'll be able to talk to a lot of people. 5 watt output from a handy talkie can do a rather good job, not a perfect job, but a rather good job with a good mag mount antenna. If you had a real, let me drop it. If you had a real mobile rig connected to the cigarette lighter or to the battery, which ran 30 watts or 50 watts to a mag mount antenna outside the car, now that's a Cadillac setup. Now every repeater you can hear, you can talk to. Your only other problem then is if you're traveling at 2 o'clock in the morning in your automobile in order to avoid traffic, there may be nobody on the repeater. If you're traveling at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, there's lots of people listening to the repeater, but in some cases, if you don't sound interesting enough, they might not answer you. You gotta sound intelligent. So when it comes to traveling in your automobile and talking to people while you travel, find out where the... In the travels that I've made, I found out where the best local restaurant was. I once had a leak in my radiator, and a ham came on and told me where the best radiator repair place was, which was an extremely nice repair shop, which was not at all obvious downtown. You had to drive down a certain alley to find this place, but when you did, boy, did he do a good job at a very nice place. I never would have known he was there without a local ham over the local repeater telling me that. One other time, let me drop it. One other time, I was on Route 76 in Pennsylvania, and my transmission of my station wagon blew up, and I'm on 2 meters at the time, and I described what had happened as my transmission acted like it went to neutral, and the car would never move after that. That guy found out where I was. He asked me, what's the number on the nearest telephone pole? I gave him that, because I didn't remember what exit number I had just passed. He was within 15 miles of where I was. He got in his car and he came out and picked me up, called the local repair shop that picked up my car. He brought me home to his house and he put me up for the day that it took to repair my car. So having a mobile rig in the car really is nice. And if you've got a driving occupation like KTUPS, boy is it nice to have a radio in the car. K2 Uncle Papa Sierra. Tell us where you're located tonight, Rich. K2RIW. You got it, Rich.
Good evening, Dick. North of the Net. I'm in Pennsylvania right now. I'm still on I-70. A little bit less of a span. But the gentleman that's going to be traveling to Canada... I'm not sure what the simplex frequencies are up there, but you can monitor that while you're driving. Although the 518T, if you're trying to talk to someone that happens to be listening from a home station, you're not going to get, you won't be talking too long because you'll be out of range pretty quick. But there is a program and a website. There probably is a slight fee involved. I actually subscribed to it myself. It's rfinder.net. Rfinder.net. There's apps for your cell phone, and it's also a computer program. But what's neat about, well, it's actually a website, it's not a program you use. Go to the website and use it. You can actually program in the route that you're going to travel, and it will give you a list of all of the repeaters in order that you'll find, or that you should be able to be within range. And if then you take the time before you leave and program them all in, and you should be. When I'm driving, I haven't used the website all that much, but I do use the app.
Colin, good information, Rich. Thank you. KTUPS, Rich, K2RIW. So let's see if Bob was able to make some sense out of that. So as I see it, whatever radio you got, an external antenna on the car is requirement number one. Requirement number two is to find out what repeaters you're going to be driving near, what frequencies they're on, and how to talk to them. And that will give you a lot of people to talk to most of the time. And then the third requirement, if you really want to be a Cadillac, would be to put a real mobile rig in the car that can put out 30 watts. But the 5 watts out of a handy talkie versus 30 watts. That's only a 10 decibel difference. That would make a 30 mile range go down to a 15 mile range, so to speak. You're still going to be able to talk to well equipped repeaters that are on a good location. Hello, Delta 2, November, Victor Bravo, K2RIW. You got it, Bob.
Thanks for that info. Yes, from Rich, was that was rfinder.net, so just the letter R and then the word finder with no space or anything between .net. I will look that up and I'll look at the website and the app. I have an iPhone, I have an old iPhone, it's a 4S. I'm only running iOS 7, so that may be a problem these days. But I'll look into all that. That sounds really good. I already knew something about the repeaters, looking them up, and I have Chirp, and I had already downloaded some, but still, the dilemma in the root sounds like a great idea. Yeah, yes, I have a 5-watt HD. I guess I'm not going to be getting a 30 watts between now and next week, but I think my uncle has to let me put this Magnum 10 on his car. I hope he's not too fussy about that. But the uncle's lit. I've got a highly rated, you know, for what it is, Magnum half meter antenna for 2 meter and 440. And so I'll have that with me, and I'll just be using that some of the time, maybe when we're not driving or something. And great. That's all great information, and I thank you guys. I'm hoping I can use this Magmont at home. I'm just in an apartment at home. Now, I'm dovetailing another possible question, but I don't know if you want to take this up or not, but a nebulous subject of what kind of indoor antenna you could use in a third-story apartment when you can't put anything on your roof or outside, etc. But I can do that another time. So thanks again for all the info, and you know, if anybody else has anything to say, feel free. Over to you, Jake, or anybody.
Yeah, a well-designed Magnav antenna is an extremely handy thing. When you put it on the top of the roof of the car that has a metal roof, they usually have a piece of plastic underneath so it doesn't scratch the paint. At first, you think you're going to bring the cable into a partially open window of the car. No, you're not. The right way to do is to bring it into the door. You open up the door, you lay the cable across the where the door is going to close with duct tape. You tape the cable down so it goes around the edge of the door down to the bottom of the door, and then you bring it into the car. When you do it that way, any water that gets past the rubber gasket around the door goes down the cable and doesn't roll inside the car. When you bring the cable in from around the door, when the door is open and you're looking at the door jamb, so to speak, you're bringing that cable around the perimeter of the door and bringing it in to the door near the floor. And there the water would have to roll uphill to get past that rubber gasket to get into the car. And you won't be dripping rubber into the water into the car. So there's a little bit of an art form to bring in the cable correctly. You're not doing any permanent damage. You're not putting any holes in the car. You're not damaging the wooden, the rubber door seal or whatever. Let me drop it. And in the case of a handy talkie, I do recommend you to buy the adapter that allows you to run off the cigarette lighter into the handy talkie, because no matter what batteries you've got on the handy talkie, when you find somebody interesting to talk to while you're driving and you're talking to repeaters, you're going to run those batteries down, and it's going to be very annoying. So you're going to want a battery eliminator that runs off the cigarette lighter into your handy talkie. And that's a fairly common item that's not very expensive. Either that or a great big pile of batteries, if you know what I mean. In some cases, you can buy an adapter for your handy talkie, which allows you to plug in alkaline batteries, or you can buy a whole lot of individual rechargeable batteries and make sure they're always recharged. But the battery eliminator is the best approach. And see, there's another point I was going to make, but I think, let's see if Chick's got any further things to add. Oh, yeah. Once you've got this mag mount, which works so beautifully on the car, the mag mount works beautifully inside of an apartment building.
you can stick it to the side of the refrigerator. And that stops the power is up. A repeater that's vertical. Don't allow that to intimidate you. Let me drop. If you want to be a purist, maybe you can find a radiator or something else that the mag mount will stick to that's vertically polarized. But a horizontally polarized mag mount stuck to the side of a refrigerator can work like a charm. That time that signal bounces off your refrigerator, bounces off the plumbing and everything else and all the wiring that's inside your apartment, and by the time that signal gets out of your apartment, you think it's going to be horizontally polarized? No way. It's going to have every polarization in the world. Whether or not it started off horizontal or vertical in the middle of your apartment almost doesn't matter. So a mag mount is a very handy thing to use inside of an apartment. The next best thing beyond a mag mount would be a homebrew Yagi made out of coat hanger wire. If you go to the website WA5VJV, Whiskey Alpha 5, Victor Juliet Bravo. He's got a website where he sells green printed circuit UHF antennas. But if you go to his page number 2 or page number 3, he will show you how to make a Yagi made out of coat hanger wire. 5-7 elements, you can make a 2-meter or a 440 Yagi that you mount to a broom handle stick in your apartment, and now you've got some real 2-meter or 440 antenna gain that you can aim in a particular direction. That's the next best step inside of an apartment above a mag mount. But a mag mount in an apartment can do an extremely good job if you are within, let me pick a number, 10 miles of a major metropolitan repeater. It's not going to give you 30 miles of range, but it's going to give you 10 miles of range unless you're in the basement of that apartment. Let's see what Rich has got to add to all of this. K2UPS Mobile in Pennsylvania. K2LIW, go ahead, Rich.
And K2UPS Mobile returning. A good apartment antenna, and just a good all-around portable antenna for 2 meters and 40, 440, is Ed Fong's dual band J-Pole. Made out of like television twin leads. You can roll it up and stick it in your pocket. When you want to use it in an apartment, you can use a little piece of cut tape and stick it to a window. You can hang it from a curtain rod. You can hang it from the lamp in the middle of the ceiling. You're not going to hurt anybody if they walk into it. You don't have to worry about sticking it on metal. It really works out great. I don't remember what Ed's call is, but if you Google Ed Fong, Fox Red Ocean Anti-Golf is his last name, and the antenna is the DJV, he's actually got a new version, DJV2, Delta Juliet Bravo, -2. I'm sure you'll come up with his website. I believe he also sells them out to eBay, on an eBay site. He's actually a college professor out in California, and he has some of his students, I think, producing these things as a class exercise, but they work really well. I have several of them, and that does work well. And Bob, if you shoot me an email, my call is good on URZ, or you can send it via my call at ARRL. I'll also get it. I can then send you some information. K2UPS.
WS1.
Paul, recognize that was K2 Uncle Bravo, UPS. K2 Uniform Papa Sierra stands for, you know what UPS stands for, the UPS Delivery Service. He just happens to work for them, and therefore he's going to call it. And that's good information. So Ed Fong, F-O-N-G, Delta Juliet Bravo -2 antenna, and if you simply Google the word J-Pole antenna, that's another way you'll find an awful lot of articles on how to build homebrew J-Pole antennas for very inexpensive prices. But the Ed Fong looks like a very good one. Paul's going to get it with some information. WS2F. K2RIW. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, as far as supplying power to the HT, for years I've been using the, well, in my case, the C Sears battery jumping booster.